Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. The sounds of every Bay Area are unique. In ours, we have a healthy mix of cormorant squawks, auto traffic from the bridges, ferries cutting the waves, and, of course, all the frickin' seagulls. In the bay and seashores off of New York City, a rare sound has returned as a particular population of New Yorkers are making a comeback. The podcast, The Briny, trawls aquatic communities for stories about the science and culture of our seas. Journalist Matt Frassica launched the show with an investigation into how the whale populations decreased in the New York Bight and why they've returned.
One hot day in New York, I rode a bus out to Rockaway Beach and boarded a boat called the American Princess. I wanted to see a whale, and if you're looking for a whale in New York, you basically have two options. You can go see the giant model of a blue whale that hangs from the ceiling in the American Museum of Natural History, or you can go on a whale watch on the American Princess with a group called Gotham Whale. The boat slowed down about 15 miles south of the city in an area of the ocean called New York Bight. That's B-I-G-H-T, not bite like chomp.
Somebody look around here, right where the whales were yesterday here, and
That's Paul Cyswerda, the founder of Gotham Whale. He was our guide on this trip.
Just that we gotta try to find them.
Everyone on board went to the rails and scanned the waves and waited. This was the watch part of Whale Watch. I went over to talk with Danielle Brown, a researcher with Gotham Whale.
And is it a relatively new thing for whales to be here or here in these kind of numbers?
Well, whales have always been in the area. They've always been in the New York Bight. However, it was thought that humpback whales were mainly here in the wintertime. So what we've been seeing since Gotham Whale started in 2011 is that there's been... I just had a breach! Sorry! I just breached! Holy crap! 3 o'clock! Breach 3 o'clock! Did anybody see that?
The boat turned and motored toward the whale.
Chris will probably never find it again. That was...
I tried to hang on and keep talking with Danielle, but the waves were getting choppy, and suddenly... I didn't feel so good. You're listening to The Briny, a show about stories from the sea. I'm Matt Frassica. I went out in that boat to see for myself something that I've been reading about, that there seemed to be a lot more whales around New York City than there used to be, swimming just a few miles from the biggest, most densely populated city in the country. When Gotham Whale first started going out, they didn't see much.
Well, when we started in 2011, we really were fairly sparse in our sightings. We had five animals that we saw in three sightings.
But since then, they've seen more and more whales.
So we saw more than double each year, and in 2014, we had a total of 86 sightings, and we counted 106 whales.
Until recently, whale sightings around New York City were scarce. And that's because of us, our pollution, noise, fishing lines, and shipping traffic. And because, for a very long time, we were hunting them.
Whaling is an ancient profession. It's been around for thousands of years.
Eric J. Dolan is the author of Leviathan, A History of the American Whaling Industry. And his story goes back to the beginning of European colonization.
When the Mayflower landed in Provincetown In 1620, the ship was immediately surrounded by a bunch of spouting whales.
The colonists would boil down the whales' thick layer of blubber to make candles. At first, they just used the whales that washed up on the beach. But soon, they started rowing out in small boats to harpoon the whales near the shore, until there were no more whales near the shore. So they built ships and went out to hunt whales in the open ocean.
You would have one or two men climb up the mainmast, maybe 100 foot above the waves, and they're scanning the horizon for the telltale spout. They would yell, "Whale off," and then there'd be a sudden rush to get to their whale boats, lower them over the side, jump in, and they would all race to see who could be the first to get to the whale. And once you got to the whale, you would launch the harpoon. Whale blubber is extremely dense and fibrous. It is hard to puncture it, and the skin is very tough. And then once you got one harpoon into the whale, you would try your best to get a second harpoon, because that gives you better purchase. And the whale by this point, who does not like it at all to have been punctured on the side of its body, is going to take off. After a while, the whale would tire dragging this whale boat. And then the boat steerer would go up with a lance to get the life of the whale. And you would know that success had been achieved if you suddenly saw a geyser of crimson blood coming out of the whale's blowhole. And that was called chimneys of fire.
Whaling companies in Nantucket, New Bedford, and New York got rich sending these floating factories out to sea. They wouldn't come back until their holds were full of whale oil.
In the mid-1850s, they were bringing in, on average, about 8,000 to 9,000 whales a year. It was one of the largest industries in the United States.
As the industry became more efficient and deadly, the whales themselves became harder to find.
We started going farther and farther afield to get an ever-diminishing number of whales.
Whaling expeditions went around the tip of South America to reach the Pacific and up to the Arctic to find fresh hunting grounds where the whale populations hadn't been decimated.
But what happened in every other place in the world also happened in the Arctic. There was an Arctic whale rush, and so many whale ships went north. After just a few short years, 5-10 years, the population levels plummeted.
The whalers themselves recognized that they were hunting their prey to extinction. In 1850, one of them wrote an open letter that appeared in a Honolulu newspaper, where lots of their compatriots would see it because Honolulu was a routine port of call for whale ships in the Pacific. The letter was written from the point of view of an Arctic whale.
"I write in behalf of my butchered and dying species, and I appeal to the friends of the whole race of whales. Must we all be murdered? Must our race become extinct? Will no friends and allies arise and revenge our wrongs?"
But it didn't change anything. It would be 100 years before the international treaty that put an end to widespread whaling.
My father came back from World War II and started a fishing business in 1945, and we've been in the boating business ever since.
That's Tom Palladino, captain of the American Princess. Over his decades on the water, he's watched New York Harbor come back to life.
The waters are getting cleaner. There's a lot more birds than we've ever seen before, a lot more whales, a lot more dolphin, sharks, everything.
In November, a humpback whale came up the Hudson River. People living on the Upper West Side could see it from their windows. And in January, the NYPD found another humpback in the East River, on the other side of Manhattan. Humpback whales are actually one of the success stories of whale conservation. Last year, the U.S. government took most of the world's humpback populations off the endangered species list. Paul from Gotham Whale thinks that humpbacks are coming back to New York in particular because one of their favorite foods has returned, a type of fish called menhaden.
The local fishermen call these fish bunker, and they're about 10, 12 inches long, and they form great schools, and they form what's known as bait balls, which is a tight concentration of these animals. And then these whales lunge feed by coming up through these bait balls and taking in hundreds of gallons of water and fish in one gulp, and it makes a very efficient feeding behavior for the whales.
Not all whale species are doing as well as humpbacks.
My name is Mark Baumgartner. I'm a marine ecologist, and I work at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution.
One of the species that scientists like Mark worry about the most is the North Atlantic right whale. They were hit very hard by the whaling industry. In fact, that's how they got that name.
When they were hunted, they were the right whale to kill because they were slow-moving, coastal, and when you killed them, they floated, so you could tow them back to shore.
About 1,000 years of hunting brought right whales to the edge of extinction.
By the time right whales received international protection in 1932, the population was probably very, very low, maybe in the tens of animals.
Mark says even now, there are as few as 525 right whales in the world.
That's an incredibly low number. A species that has a population that low, small changes in the environment, small changes in their birth rate or their death rate can make a huge difference. And we as humans don't have a lot of time to respond when things are going poorly. And I say that because for right whales right now, things are starting to go poorly. Their death rates are up and their calving rates are down. And so the population's starting to show signs of decline. And that's a very bad thing for a population that only has 525 animals in it.
Right whales spend a lot of time in shallow water near the shore, so they cross paths with humans a lot more than, say, sperm whales that live farther out to sea. As a result, the biggest dangers right whales face are getting tangled up in fishing gear and getting hit by ships.
You can see propeller scars, flukes that are just cleanly cut off.
In 2008, the U.S. government put regulations in place to slow down large ships as they go into port near right whale habitats, kind of like a 25-mile-per-hour zone around schools. And it turns out that just slowing these ships down can help save whales.
It collisions over 10 knots for large ships, ships over 65 feet long, typically end up in a mortality, in a death of the whale. Whereas if they're going slower than that, then either the whale has time to get out of the way, or the whale gets hit, but it isn't killed.
Those regulations slowed ships down near ports, but in the open ocean, it's almost impossible for ship captains to know if there are whales nearby. It's not like every whale has a tracking device on it. And it turns out, if you want to find out where the whales are, you have to listen. Whales make lots of sounds, and those sounds can travel for miles underwater. So, if you're listening, you could hear when a group of whales is in the area and tell ships to slow down. Last summer, Mark and his team from Woods Hole put an underwater microphone, a hydrophone, at the bottom of New York Bight to listen for whales. The hydrophone picks up whale song and sends data about what it hears back to Mark's lab on Cape Cod. And what they've found from listening to the bottom of New York Bight has been a little surprising. For one thing, they're hearing a lot more of this than they expected. That's a fin whale, the second largest animal on Earth after the blue whale.
I did not expect that. That's been a bit surprising to me. But it's not like there are millions of fin whales out there. There may be hundreds of fin whales out there, or in the low thousands.
Mark thinks maybe the reason they're hearing so many fin whale calls is that the sounds themselves are lower and travel farther than sounds made by other species. In fact, the sounds they make are so low that this has been sped up 24 times.
If I played them for you on a computer, you wouldn't be able to hear them because they're so low frequency. You'd have to be in a, you know, like in a movie theater to be able to hear this low rumbling sound that they make.
But another surprise has been how often the researchers hear this. That is a right whale. Right whales are thought to migrate between their summer grounds up north and the coast off the southeastern U.S., where they go to have babies in the wintertime. So Mark expected to hear them in New York Bight as they passed through in the spring and fall.
And that hasn't happened at all. What we've seen is right whales were detected in November, but then they were detected in December and detected in January and detected in February. So we've been seeing right whales, not all the time, but we certainly hear them every couple of days.
That's great, but the port of New York and New Jersey is the largest port on the East Coast, with giant container ships and tankers going through New York Bight year-round. That makes it a very dangerous place for whales.
That area tends to be one of the highest areas of ship strikes for whales along the entire East Coast.
Right now, Mark sends email and text notifications out when his group hears whales in New York Bight. And he hopes those warnings will eventually go straight to the ships so captains can know to slow down when whales are nearby.
I think it's very fair to say that no ship's captain wants to hit a whale. And so I think that there's certainly an interest in seeing this information out there so that ships can make intelligent decisions about their operations.
But it's not just right whales getting hit by ships. In April, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration reported an unusual number of humpbacks turning up dead over the past year, about twice as many as a normal year, and a lot of them were cut up by propellers. Even as there are more and more whales showing up near New York Harbor, the port just finished a $2 billion project to deepen the harbor so a new class of supersized container ships can dock at the port.
Right there! 1 o'clock! 1 o'clock!
Paul Siswerda and Gotham Whale will keep going out, documenting the whales returning to the waters around New York. But he's worried about what's going to happen when increasing numbers of whales show up in those busy shipping lanes.
Playing in traffic is not usually a good idea.
Over the last 100 years, humans have gone from hunting whales almost to extinction to studying and protecting them. But without more effort to keep them out of harm's way, we'll continue to kill them by mistake.
That piece was produced in 2017 by Matt Frasica for The Briny, a podcast about our connections to the sea. You can find The Briny anywhere you listen to podcasts, like iTunes, Stitcher, or Radio Public. You can also find all of their episodes at thebriny.net. You're tuned to The Spot, KALW's weekly showcase of the best stories made by indie radio and podcast producers. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Off of another coast in Port Isaac, England, a seaside community has marked themselves by a distinctive sound.
We're making money with this sound.
Rallin' winches all.
Soon we'll all be homeward bound.
Rallin' winches all. Rallin' down a
But as the fishing industry continues its decline, they wonder what will happen to the musical traditions they've formed around it. In 2012, Peabody Award-winning writer and producer DeMay Roberts talked with the Fisherman's Friends singing group at their headquarters, the local pub, about what makes their style of singing so special to them.
When I first heard the Fisherman's Friends, I was struck by the wall of sound that marks their harmonies.
Come on, you know, hopers, you jokers and rogues. We're on the road to nowhere, let's find out where it goes. It might be a ladder to the stars, who knows. Come on, you know, hopers, you jokers and rogues.
Most of the men grew up together in the Cornish village of Port Isaac. They started singing Christmas carols and sea shanties just for fun, but they soon became so popular they were drawing thousands to their free summer concerts. I met with 8 members of the group at their headquarters, the Golden Lion Pub near the old harbor, which the town calls the Platte.
My name's Julian Brown, and I'm a fisherman.
I'm John McDonald. I'm a builder in this village.
Billy Hawkins. I ran the pottery in Port Isaac.
John Brown. I live in the village. Part-time fisherman.
Trevor Grills, a builder. Born in the village. Live in the village. Everything in the village.
I'm John Lethbridge, and I'm the only one that don't live in the village. I live in St. Cue, about 4 miles away.
Peter Rowe, old and retired.
I'm John Cleave. I'm Peter's next-door neighbour, so I look after him.
At 78, Peter Rowe is the elder statesman of the group. He says men in Cornwall love to sing.
The Cornish do have a tradition, and you can go to nearly small town, big town, and find a group of guys who are just as good as us.
John Cleave says most of them were in choirs when they were growing up. The group doesn't have a director. Usually someone sings a chorus or two.
And within 10 minutes you can tell if everyone else wants to sing it or not. It's a bit of an acid test, and, you know, sometimes it can take a little longer to get through. Sometimes you pick songs up right away, and sometimes it's readily apparent that you should never have brought this song along, and I'll get my coat then.
What they do agree on, says John Brown, is the type of music.
All our sea shanties are to do with the sea and to work with the hauling of sails, hauling up the anchor up, and various little jobs on board. But it'd be usually be a gang of people working together.
Peter Rowe demonstrates a song about winches on a sailing ship.
Stamp and go is pulling and stamping at the same time to get your balance right. Is that correct, boy? Pulling and stamp and go. Stamp and go, stamp and go. You're pulling on a rope, see, to all whatever act you're taking.
We're making money with this sound.
Row them winches, oh. Row them down and stamp and go. Row them winches, oh. Woo! Rattling down and stamp and go, rattling winches, oh.
In the hold this gear must go,
rattling winches, oh.
For Mr. Mate has told me so,
rattling winches, oh. Rattling down and stamp and go, rattling winches, oh. Woo! Rattling down and stamp and go, rattling winches, oh.
The songs may be upbeat, but they document the real danger fishermen face, says John Brown.
Fishing's still the most dangerous occupation in the world. Obviously, you fall overside, and if you haven't got a life jacket on, within 10 minutes, you will drown. But you could drown in a harbour. If you can't grab hold of something, you'll drown in 10 minutes.
His brother Julian Brown says that a quota system for fish forces the fishermen to throw dead fish back into the ocean. He worries about the decline of the industry.
Well, there just isn't enough money to cover the cost. The price of fuel is rising all the time, which makes it more difficult. And with the restrictions about what you can land, that makes it difficult. No, it's for the last 20 or 30 years, it's just been on a downward spiral.
Do you worry that your son is going into this?
That's why I try to keep pushing him away.
Yet the men say their children don't seem eager to leave Port Isaac, and neither are they, says John Brown.
We've all lived here for the best part of 50 years, and none of us have wanted to move away, or we've moved away but always come back. And you look out the window there, and this is what it's all about. It's a better community, but all your friends together, and living and working in a little village. The children's children grew up together, and our children's children have grown up together, and it's just absolutely fantastic.
Still, their popularity often draws the Fisherman's Friends away from home. Last year, they signed on with the Universal Music Group. Then they performed at the prestigious Royal Festival and Royal Albert Halls in London, as well as the world-famous Glastonbury Festival. Trevor Grill says they never expected this.
When we first started, we said we'll give it 2 years, and it's kind of going on. It's a bit like being on the crest of a wave, like surfing, I imagine it. You're on the top of the wave, and you're just going along with it. We'll just take it as far as it goes.
Are you cueing a Beach Boys song, Trevor?
For we sail on the sloop, John B., my grandpappy and me, over the seven seas we did roll.
The Fisherman's Friends ride that wave this summer, giving concerts in Port Isaac and around England. I'm Dime Roberts, Port Isaac.
Well, I feel so broke up.
Oh, yeah.
I want to go
home.
So hoist up the John B.
That piece was produced by Demay Roberts in 2012. Hear more songs at thefishermansfriends.com and listen to more of Demay's work at her website, demayroberts.com.
We are two mariners, our ship's sole survivors in this belly of a whale. Its ribs are ceiling beams, its guts are carpeting. I guess we have some time to kill. You may not remember me, I was a child of three, and you a lad of 18. But I remember you, and I will relate to you how our histories interweave. At the time you were a rake and harassed about, spending all your money on the whores and hounds. Oh, you had a charming air, all cheap and debonair, my widowed mother found so sweet, and so she took you in, her sheets still warm. Him, now filled with filth and foul disease. As time wore on, you proved a dead-ridden drunkenness, leaving my mother a poor consumptive wretch. Oh, oh, and then you disappeared, your gambling arrears, the only thing you left behind. And then the magistrate reclaimed our small estate, and my poor mother lost her mind. Then one day in spring, my dear sweet mother died. But before she did, I took her hand as she dying cried. Oh.
That's all we have for you today on The Spot. You can find this episode and over 90 others at KALW.org. Just look for The Spot under Programs A to Z. Feel free to share your favorite podcasts and radio stories with me via email at thespot@KALW.org. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Thanks for listening. And tune in next week for another episode of The Spot, only on 91.7 KALW.
Keep their vestry nice and neat.